Welcome to The Rest is History, the podcast that needs no vaccine passport to roam freely across the boundaries and the centuries. And today we're heading back in time 3,500 years, and we're going to be starting by talking about a boy who took the throne in Egypt when he was about 8 years old and proceeded to marry his half-sister. Or did he? So much of his life is shrouded in mystery. Our subject, or at least the subject that we're going to kick off with, is of course Tutankhamun, who's captivated our imaginations since Howard Carter discovered his tomb 99 years ago. But of course, there's more to Tutankhamun than the boy himself or the tomb. Tom Holland is with me. Tom, this is a subject I know you know loads about and has fascinated you since you were a kid. Let's start with just Tutankhamun, because he's the one pharaoh that everybody has heard of. What is it about him, do you think, that has seized our imagination?
Yeah, he's the most famous pharaoh by miles. And yet, when he was alive, he didn't reign for very long. He was a very obscure pharaoh. And the reason, of course, that he is famous is that he is the pharaoh whose tomb, full of treasure, survived the depredations of robbers. And so when we think about the glory of the pharaohs, this kind of golden realm, we think of Tutankhamun, because there we get a glimpse of the incredible wealth, the sophistication, the beauty of that incredible civilization. But on top of that, I think there are two further reasons why Tutankhamun is so famous and why his story is so haunting. The first is the story of how it was found. So the process by which Howard Carter came to uncover the tomb, you know, it goes back years and decades. And it's kind of the last gasp. Howard Carter is about to have his funding cut, and then he discovers this stairway, and he peel away the dust, and they get down, and there's a door, and it's intact. And you've got the story of the curse and everything. So that's brilliant. But I think even more than that, what makes it fascinating from the historical point of view is that, obscure though Tutankhamun is, he is an actor in what is perhaps the most remarkable, extraordinary, enigmatic period in Egyptian history, which is associated with the guy who was probably his father, a pharaoh called Akhenaten, who was married to a queen whose face is almost as famous as Tutankhamun's, Nefertiti's. And Akhenaten is famous as the pharaoh who essentially initiates an entirely exceptional process of revolution that was so shocking and upsetting to the Egyptians that they buried his name in oblivion. And Tutankhamun's name was buried as well. And that's basically why his tomb survived, because he was forgotten about.
Okay. Don't tell us what Akhenaten did, because for listeners who don't know, that can be our big reveal later on when we get into the Akhenaten story. Because I agree with you. I think the Akhenaten story is one of the... I think it's, without any question, one of the single most interesting stories in all world history. And I'm talking about thousands of years. But let's just focus for a second about Howard Carter. Now, Howard Carter's story, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's one that all children learn, certainly all British children. And what is it about it, do you think, that, you know, he's working for Lord Carnarvon? I mean, I can remember this from the books I read as a kid. You know, he's working for Lord Carnarvon, and there's the story about the curse and the dog barking in Cairo or whatever.
That's right.
He's dying and
yes,
all this sort of.
Yes.
So how much, tell us, I mean, you'll know much more about this than me. Tell us some of the sort of background to all this. So Carter was, he was a professional archaeologist?
No, he wasn't. And this is part of the romance of it, is that he was an illustrator. And he went out as quite a young man to Egypt. And there he met the brilliantly named Flinders Petrie, who was an archaeologist. And Flinders Petrie was working at a site called Amarna, which is about halfway between Luxor and Cairo.
And now, don't spoil the reveal by telling us about Amarna.
I won't. But so this is a part of what Howard Carter immediately gets gripped by. And this is a buried city that hasn't been excavated before. So it's kind of virgin territory. And Carter is doing the illustrations for this. And he just completely gets the bug. He stays on. He ends up being employed. The French at the time are running the Antiquities Service in Egypt for kind of complicated colonial reasons. And Carter is employed by this colonial French agency, basically to as a superintendent of antiquities, until he gets into a punch-up with some French tourists who are essentially being incredibly rude to an Egyptian. And Carter takes the Egyptian side and gets dismissed for this. So the sense that...
It's a good story.
Yeah, it's so Carter is kind of on the side of the angels, but he's a temperamental, difficult man. And from that point on, he stays out in Egypt and he basically hires himself out to visiting grandees, billionaires, Americans, British, whoever, who essentially coming to Egypt and they buy kind of the right to excavate certain areas and they employ Carter. And there's a guy called Theodore Davies, who's an American millionaire who comes to the Valley of the Kings, and Carter helps him out. Theodore Davies discovers all kinds of fascinating tombs. One in particular, KV55, so King Valley of the Kings 55, is an enigmatic tomb that I'm sure we'll come to with a mummy in it. It's unclear whether it's male or female. It seems to have been some process of desecration going on. No one's quite sure about it. Davis discovers this in 1912. He then thinks that, or is it 1907? Can't remember. Anyway, we'll have to check. He then reckons that the whole of the Valley of the Kings, every tomb has been discovered. But Carter, because there is a link between Tutankhamun and Amarna that we'll come to, he's particularly aware of the fact that Tutankhamun's tomb has not been found, that this is the one tomb that might be discovered. And so when Lord Carnarvon comes out, who is there for his health, you know, the Egyptian climate is seen as being very healthy, he comes out, he employs Carter. Carter says, look, let's go for Tutankhamun. And they dig and they dig and they dig and they don't find it. And years go by and 1922 comes around and Carnarvon says to Carter, look, this is going to be the last season. And Carter goes, OK. And that's the jeopardy. And then Carter discovers it and he has to wait for Lord Carnarvon to come over. They go down secretly without telling anyone, and Carter kind of opens up the door, and Carnarvon's behind him and says, you know, can you see anything? And Carter says, you know, there's this pause, and then he says, wonderful, I can see things, I can see wonderful things. And the romance of it is so incredible. It's the kind of the paradigm of what people imagine an archaeologist's life is like.
But it never is, isn't it? That's the tragedy.
It never is.
But no other archaeologist ever has that.
No archaeologist has ever had that kind of Howard Carter experience. And then you throw into the mix the story of the curse, which is that the story goes, there's this guy who is a rival of Carter's called Arthur Weigel, who was employed by the Daily Mail, Dominic, so very much the lowest of the low. To cover the excavation, and Carnarvon has given exclusive rights to the Times. So Weigel is there. He's resentful of Carter for this great find. He's cross.
They were owned by the same group in those days in the 1920s. That's the irony.
He's cross that the Times has got the exclusive, and so he sees Carnarvon going in, and he's supposed to have said, if he goes in that mood, I give him 6 weeks. And then the story goes that he nicks himself shaving, it gets infected. And this nick supposedly exactly models a nick that will be found on the face of Tutankhamun. You're right that the moment he dies, there's a power cut across Cairo, and his dog back in Highclere, which is Downton Abbey, howls. And this is the story of the curse. But Carter, obviously, the person who proves that the curse isn't real is Carter, because he does not die of it.
How disappointing.
Yeah, it is disappointing.
Okay, so there's also, I mean, obviously with Tutankhamun, a huge element of the appeal, again, before we get into the Akhenaten stuff, a huge element of the appeal is that he's a child, is that he's a boy pharaoh, and we always have this fascination.
He's kind of late teens, isn't he?
But he becomes, what, he's 8 or 9 when he becomes
Yeah, he kind
pharaoh,
of dies about
I
when
suppose.
He's about 17, I think.
So in other words, he's the same age as a lot of children when they first read about Tutankhamun, and it's that sort of sense of doomed youth, I think, that people, it's the sort of the contrast between the doomed youth and then the gilded but ossified splendor of the remains that I think we often like about the Tutankhamun story. And of course that's why we go to museums and we enjoy seeing all the artifacts, but the intellectual appeal of the story, and this is where we come to the big reveal, is it's really his father, who's this fellow called Akhenaten, who must be one of the most fascinating and mysterious characters in all human history. And I know you are passionate about this, so why don't you tell us the, you know, give us an outline for people who don't know anything about ancient Egypt. Give us the story.
Okay, so Akhenaten is the son of a pharaoh called Amenhotep, which means basically Amun is pleased. And Amun-Re is the, by the time that this is, so this is kind of 1370, 1360 BC. It's in the 18th dynasty of Egypt. And Egypt is...
So Egypt's been going for like...
Yeah, it's been going for...
More than 1,000 years.
Yes, yes, yes. It's an incredibly ancient civilization. And under the 18th dynasty, it's incredibly powerful. Egypt had been occupied by Asiatic invaders called Hyksos. And they had been expelled by the ancestor of the 18th dynasty. And not only had the Asiatics been expelled, but the pharaohs had then expanded northwards and established a kind of loose empire reaching right the way up into Syria. And Amenhotep III is kind of like the Louis the XIV of ancient Egypt. He is the sun king. Everything about him is golden. He's wealthy. He rules
massive
for a very,
statues.
Very long time. Huge statues. So if you go to the British Museum, there's a huge kind of head of him with this kind of enigmatic, rather self-satisfied smile, as well you might be if you were Amenhotep III. And the priests of Amun are basically... you know, they're massive. They're a kind of massive power in the land. They run these huge, vast temples. And Amenhotep III's son, who will succeed him and become Amenhotep IV, is actually committed to another god. And a few years into his reign, he signals this by changing his name from Amenhotep. Amun is pleased to Akhenaten, which means basically you do stuff for the Aten, and the Aten is the disk of the sun, and Akhenaten's devotion to the Aten is such that he basically launches a kind of an attack against Amun. He closes the temples to Amun. He moves to this place that now is called Amarna, where Howard Carter and Flinders Petrie were digging, and which at the time was called, Akhenaten calls it Akhetaten, the horizon of the Aten. And Akhenaten builds an entire city there devoted to the worship of this god Aten. And the thing that's astonishing about this, and something that has kind of echoed through, you know, Freud writes about it, all kinds of people write about it, is that essentially Akhenaten is a monotheist, and he's a monotheist who is reacting against the vast array of gods that the Egyptians have always taken for granted. And he writes these kind of hymns. We assume that Akhenaten writes them. We don't absolutely know this for sure, but yeah, he's conventionally
the great hymn to the Aten.
And he hails the Aten as sole god without another beside him. And in the context of, you know, of Egyptian assumptions about the universe, about the role played by the gods, this is so revolutionary, and that Egypt is left kind of stunned by it. And when Akhenaten dies, the process of kind of rolling this revolution back begins immediately, because Tutankhamun is initially called Tutankhaten. So Tutankhaten is the living image of the Aten. Tutankhamun, he becomes living image of Amun. And Tutankhamun becomes the kind of figurehead of a counter-revolution, which then he dies. He gets succeeded probably by his great-uncle, a guy called Ai. Then Ai dies, and he gets succeeded in turn by a guy called Horemheb, who is a kind of general. And it's under Horemheb that the entire memory of Akhenaten and his revolution basically gets flattened. And Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, Ai, they all get written out of the king lists, so that, you know, a few centuries on, although there are very interesting kind of echoes of the horror of this that are buried, Akhenaten's own name and Tutankhamun's name get completely forgotten. And no one has any idea that they existed until Flinders Petrie arrives at Amarna and starts excavating and finding, digging up all this stuff. And basically, that's the paradox is that that is what enables Tutankhamun to survive.
So there's so much to unpack here. Maybe we'll get to the purely religious stuff, which I know you're fascinated by, and the influence of Akhenaten and the way that people have tried to understand, you know, is he the father of all our monotheistic religions and all the rest of it. But just looking back on this as a sort of historian of the 20th century, what's really striking to me about it is you have this guy who, he's had a very domineering father who was the great pharaoh, who was kind of, I think, deified in his own lifetime, Amenhotep III. Then Akhenaten comes in. He says there's a new belief system, a new cultural form. So there's a new kind of art. If you see the images of him, I mean, they're really weird, elongated of faces. Yeah. And, you know, the art has changed. He wants it has an entirely new city in the desert, a new site that's away from the old capitals. The temples are changed, so they're open-air temples. Everybody can be seen. You're being surveyed the whole time by the sun, but also by his police and by his kind of security forces and stuff. I mean, he feels a disturbingly modern figure. I mean, he's somebody that if you put him alongside, you know, Pol Pot, I mean, it sounds like a ludicrous comparison. But again, somebody who wanted to completely remake society in the service of an ideology. Akhenaten, you know, you can paint him as an ancestor for modern totalitarians.
I think you are being a bit unfair, because I think one of the fascinations of this period is also the frustrations that there's just enough material to sense that there's something incredibly important and fascinating going on here, but there's not quite enough material to have a definite sense of what was actually going on. And we can't ultimately know for sure, you know, really what the revolution involved. We can't know for sure who, you know, even whether Tutankhamun really was Akhenaten's son. All these kind of relationships are up for grabs. And therefore, the temptation is always, when you look at someone like Akhenaten, is to back project your own assumptions. To begin with, in the kind of high Victorian period, the kind of late Victorian period, people associated Akhenaten with a kind of Victorian spirituality. He was kind of seen as an effete, lover of peace who hadn't had the cojones to stand up and fight for the Egyptian Empire. And what added to that...
And is that partly because of his statues, Tom?
Yeah, well, it's
because
partly because of...
so weird and androgynous in his...
Yeah, it's partly because of the Hymn to the Aten, where it's kind of quite a universalist hymn. So there's the sense of kind of Egypt as being radically different from the lands beyond has gone. And, you know, this is kind of very... kind of radically distinctive approach. But it's also, as you say, yes. So the Amarna art is incredibly odd. And Akhenaten is portrayed with kind of a huge, great cranium, often kind of hint of breasts, woman's hips and buttocks, and then very kind of thin, spindly legs. And when it's on engravings, these look odd. But when you get them as statues huge statues that were kind of raised at Karnak and which then got buried beneath the rubble and got extracted by 20th century excavations. And they're I think, the strangest works of art that I've ever seen. They kind of dominate.
They're really unsettling, aren't they?
So they're in the Cairo Museum, and to stand beneath them and look up at them, you feel there's a sense of power there. And so people have wondered, well, what the hell was going on here? And so people have said, well, maybe he had kind of a variety of medical conditions and this is what it's portraying. But actually, I don't think it's anything to do with that. So again and again, through pharaonic history, you look at a pharaoh and you think, oh, you know, there's one who's got huge ears. He looks like Prince Charles. Maybe that's what he looked like. And then you realize, no, it's because the ears are all listening. And the thing about the Aten is that... both male and female are contained within him. And Akhenaten is presenting himself as the son of the Aten, who alone among mortals, actually Nefertiti, his wife, does as well. But they're a kind of trinity. And so just as Nefertiti is portrayed in quite a masculine sense, and in due course after Akhenaten's death seems to have ruled as a male pharaoh, so Akhenaten in his statues is given kind of feminine characteristics. And this is entirely to do with the kind of the theological sense of what the Aten is. And I think that that's the focus of it. It's not, I don't think that by the 30s, by the 40s into the 50s, people are kind of very prone to see totalitarian dictators in this figure. Again, I don't think that's quite right, because Akhenaten is kind of, he's closer to Muhammad, I think. He's someone who for radical reasons is trying to close down the temples of other, you know, of Amun in particular, and to give no role whatsoever to other gods. And he is prepared to go as far as he can to encourage people to have a stake in that. But, you know, this is kind of Bronze Age, really. He doesn't have the apparatus of a totalitarian state to enforce that. And the measurement of that is that when he dies, the whole thing basically, like a stack of cards falls down.
Okay, well, let's hope no one says that of this podcast. We're about to take a break and we'll come back, and I think Tom will be talking to us about religion. Knowing Tom, we shall find out. See you in a minute. Welcome back to The Rest is History. We started talking about Tutankhamun, and we've gone a little bit further back, and we're talking about his father, Akhenaten, who I think is personally, I find much more interesting. Tom, there's another figure, of course, which is Nefertiti. Now, Nefertiti, Nefertiti's been in Doctor Who.
well, remember there Nefertiti. You go. That's because, the measure of historical significance, isn't it?
She went on an adventure called Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Dinosaurs and Nefertiti. It was the greatest programme ever made.
She and a Victorian explorer were fighting dinosaurs. Right. So Nefertiti, we all remember because the bust. There's a great bust of Nefertiti, and it's this fantastic
image of a head.
Yeah. Not the other kind of bust. Tell us about Nefertiti. Is she more than a head? I mean, is she more important historically?
She is a very significant figure. So the 18th dynasty has two ruling pharaohs who are female. There's Hatshepsut, great pharaoh who, wonderful mortuary temple, sends a voyage to the mysterious land of Punt. And then you have, it seems, Nefertiti. Her name means a beautiful lady has come. Nobody's entirely sure who her parents were. Probably A, though, I think, the guy who succeeds Tutankhamun. And she is very important in Akhenaten's religion. So
she's signed up to it.
She completely signs up to it.
The centre of it.
When you, in the tomb images, you have the disc of the Aten, and then you have the rays that come down. And at the end of the rays, you have hands. And these hands, they bless Akhenaten and they bless Nefertiti. And Nefertiti, unusually for queens who are standing next to their husbands, is the same size. So this is a kind of reflection of the huge significance that Nefertiti has. Now,
there were images, Tom, where they're holding hands and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're really extraordinary.
Yeah. So the sense of kind of closeness, of connubial closeness, is really important. And it was thought that for decades, that after about 12 years of Akhenaten's reign, that Nefertiti vanishes from the record and that she'd been kind of driven into disgrace. But that's no longer the consensus. And the consensus now is that after Akhenaten dies, Nefertiti takes on a male pharaonic name and seems to have ruled for several years, and then Tutankhamun succeeds her. So she's a very significant figure too. But of course, the reason that she lives in the memory is, as you say, this incredible bust that is in the Berlin Museum, that was found in the early 20th century and got taken to Berlin. And one guy who absolutely adored it, oddly, was Hitler. And Hitler was obsessed by Nefertiti. And Goering at one point was going to return the bust of Nefertiti to the Egyptian government. And Hitler personally stepped in to stop it, because his dream was that when he built the great capital of Germania after, you know, global triumph, he was going to build a massive, great complex of a museum to Egyptology. And the bust of Nefertiti was going to be kind of under a dome as the central object for it. So
so what's all that about? Because the Nazis also were really interested in the Aten story, weren't they? And the worship of the I mean, they found all that absolutely fascinating. And was that just because everybody found it fascinating in the early 20th century? Or was
the way that they can justify being enthusiastic about the beauty of Nefertiti is that, you know, her name means the beautiful lady has come. So they argue that therefore she wasn't a native Egyptian. They argue that she came of Aryan stock and that this is why she's so beautiful. So she can be enshrined as a kind of icon of Aryan womanhood. So, which is another example of people projecting fantasies onto this subject.
This is a very nice link. 20th century people projecting fantasies back onto the sort of Akhenaten, Nefertiti, Tutankhamun period, because the most famous person who does this is Sigmund Freud. And yes. I think it's his last book, Moses and Monotheism, where now he has this theory which has, I think, pretty much been debunked, but which has lasted. I mean, it's created all kinds of conspiracy theories and stuff about Akhenaten and Judaism. So do you want to take us through that? Because this really is your turf.
So Freud is thinking about Akhenaten and the relationship to Moses. Because, of course, Akhenaten is a monotheist and Moses is the legendary founder of Jewish monotheism. And Akhenaten is thinking about this as he is preparing to go into exile. He comes to London. It's the last, as you say, the last thing he's writing.
Freud, you mean? So, thank you.
Yes, Freud. Sorry, yeah, the Freudian slip there.
Not very good.
Freud is wondering not... basically, Freud is asking the question, why do people hate the Jews? Why do the Nazis hate us? Why are they doing this? And he traces it all the way back to what he sees as a kind of moment of historical trauma. And his thesis is that Moses, he points out, is an Egyptian name. So Mose means child. So Ramesses is son of Ra. And he says that the original Moses was an Atonist, so a follower of Akhenaten, who had this kind of elevated, pure spiritual monotheism. And he, after the collapse of Akhenaten's regime, he leads the Hebrews out of Egypt and preaches to them this kind of austere and uncompromising monotheism. And the Israelites get so fed up with this that they kill him. And instead they worship a Midianite god called Yahweh. And they conflate the identity of the priest that they've killed with the priest of this Midianite god, who's also called Moses, who they also come to call Moses. And so Freud says that the foundations of Judaism are this kind of buried moment of trauma that the Jews have forgotten about, that they killed their father, if you like. You can see the appeal of this to Freud, that they killed they killed this Atonist father. And basically what Freud is doing is back project, because the thing about Akhenaten is that he is reacting against the gods of Egypt.
He's reacting against his own father, though, isn't he? Amenhotep III.
Yes, he's reacting against his father, but he's also reacting against the gods. And it's this that makes him hated. And it's this that makes him kind of identified with disease and why his memory is buried. So essentially, Freud is saying that the origins of what makes the Jews hated by other people is not actually of Jewish origin. It lies with Egypt and it lies with Akhenaten and his revolution. And you're right, the people, I mean, this is a kind of, again, it's another fantasy. But it is expressive of the way in which the relationship of Akhenaten to Moses and to the tradition of monotheism is something that people kind of remain completely fascinated by. And
well, let's talk about that a bit, because that's something that's so crucial to your recent work. So in a way, we've kind of undersold what a revolution this was. So if you partly because I think it's hard for people to understand, because they think of religion as something that is a kind of optional bolt-on to your life. You know, you're religious or you're not. You kind of, it's like a hobby. You go to church on a Sunday. But for the Egyptians, and indeed for anybody at that time, you know, religion wasn't an accessory. It wasn't part of life. It was life. The gods were around you all the time. It was your entire cultural and imaginative world. So to break with that and to say, all those gods are balderdash. There's only one god and all the other gods, and all the rest of your imaginative and cultural world is a lie or is nonsense. I mean, that's a greater break than the coming of communism in Russia in 1917 or anything like that.
Completely, I mean, completely devastating, because you're erasing the entire mythology that has given meaning to your life and actually particularly to your death. So in a sense, that's the most radical thing of all, is that for the Egyptians, normally when you see the sun going through the sky and then it goes down into the underworld and there's a kind of great fight with a demon and then it comes back up again. And human beings are intimately bound up with this struggle. And as a human, you know the gods, but you don't see them. And then when you die, that's when you see the gods. But Akhenaten gets rid of all that. So he describes the Aten going through the sky and then the coming of night, and all the kind of mythology for it has gone. And so presumably all the mythology about what happens to you when you die has gone as well. And essentially, everybody in Akhenaten's Egypt, they can see the sun, so they can see the god, but they can't know it, because the only person who can know it, in fact, the only two people who can know it, are Akhenaten and Nefertiti. So essentially,
that must be frightening.
Terrifying, completely terrifying. And I think that explains the kind of the violence of the reaction against what he was taunting people. It was a kind of psychic strain that was kind of overwhelming.
But then it also explains, I suppose, because it's such a colossal break, because it's the first time somebody has said there's only one god, not lots of gods. But it's also, I guess, the first time that a single individual, a powerful individual, has said to, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of other people, what you think is wrong, you must now follow my new order. You know, it's the first time recorded instance in history of somebody creating a new order, which is something that we're now very familiar with. And because of that, it's left this huge intellectual and cultural afterlife, hasn't it? So Thomas Mann wrote about it in his book Joseph and His Brothers. Philip Glass has an opera about Akhenaten. And scholars still argue about this, don't they? There's a fellow who I know you think very highly of called Jan Assmann, a German sort of Egyptologist who's written a lot about this.
Yes, at Heidelberg, who wrote a fantastic book called Moses the Egyptian, which is essentially about it looks at how Freud kind of interprets it, but traces it all the way back, actually all the way back to the Egyptian period. And he argues that the stories that are told in the Ptolemaic period, so the period after Alexander has conquered Egypt, and then into the Roman period, that various stories are told in which trace elements of Akhenaten can just about be distinguished. And essentially, there's a story by an Egyptian priest called Manetho, who is living in the reign of the second of the Ptolemies, the royal Macedonian royal dynasty. And Manetho describes how there is a priest who leads lepers out into the desert. And the priest is from Heliopolis, so the city of Ra. So there's a kind of identification with the sun there. And he leads people who are sick with leprosy and with plague out into the desert, and he gives them kind of these strange teachings in which everything is upended. So there are no gods, the multiplicity of gods have dissolved, there is only one god, all the dietary rules that the Egyptians hold are turned on their heads. And this priest then comes back and he conquers Egypt. He has the Hyksos, the Asiatics, behind him. They rule, and then the pharaohs come and they kick them out and throw them out for good. And there's clear kind of garbled trace elements of something about Akhenaten there. But it's and this is why the association is with Freud and the Jews, is that it's kind of what Manetho is doing is he's linking this story with the Jews, because the priest who does this, Manetho says, one of the names that he has is Moses. And so it culminates, you get Tacitus writing in the beginning of the second century AD, who does this, he essentially attributes all this to the Jews. And he says, you know, the Jews, they just turn everything on their heads. They, whatever most people do, the Jews do the opposite. And
so do you think some of this does lie behind sort of historical anti-Semitism or that sort of stuff?
I think Asma's case is very convincing. I mean, I find it very convincing. And I think that the fact that this kind of radical form of monotheism existed, that clearly it was kind of remembered by the Egyptians as a kind of buried trauma, and that then in the Hellenistic and Roman period it comes to be associated with the Jews, so that the Jews then get associated with this kind of these calumnies that do seem to have inherited, you know, descended down the centuries from the actual time of Akhenaten. I mean, it's impossible to prove, because again, this is kind of the fascination and the frustration of it. But I think it's, I mean, I think it's a really fascinating take on it. Really fascinating take.
Okay, well, we've got to do some questions, haven't we? Before we do that, I forgot to mention when we came back after the break that we are now doing two podcasts a week. And our next podcast is a fantastic podcast about the history of comedy and comedy in history, history as comedy. And our guest is Al Murray. So don't miss that, please. Now, questions. Graham Elliott, Tom, says, was Tutankhamun really run over by a chariot? I hadn't heard this one, but was he? I thought he suffered from scoliosis.
Again, there are all kinds of theories about this. Being run over by chariots, another was that he was victim of a murder, kind of smashed on the side of his head. The truth is, I mean, I'm not in any way an expert on this, but whenever you look at what people deduce from mummies, it seems to change every every decade. And the classic example of that is the one that was found in KV 55, this mysterious tomb that was found by Theodore Davis, the American millionaire.
Oh, yes, you were going to mention that.
And huge controversy even about what sex it was. Was it female? Was it male? At what age was he or she when he died? And the consensus now is that it was probably a guy called Smenkere. Brilliant name, who may have been Tutankhamun's half-brother, may have succeeded Nefertiti.
But right, again, I thought Smenkere was a short-lived pharaoh.
He is a short-lived pharaoh, but we know almost nothing about him. But other people have said that this mummy may be Akhenaten, you know, maybe Nefertiti. And this is the problem, is that we know so little even about the mummies that in a sense, you take all the various pieces of this puzzle, of which the vast majority are missing, but you've got just enough pieces to kind of put them together to construct what looks like a kind of plausible picture, but you can never be sure. And the question of how pharaohs die, so how Tutankhamun dies, is a kind of classic example of that. I mean, every decade you will have some new theory that comes up. And the conclusion that I would come to as someone who is in no way qualified to do a kind of cold case autopsy like this, but it would.
He's going to do it anyway.
I don't think that we'll ever know. I don't think we'll ever know.
Right. What about this question? I mean, you mentioned about the gender, the indeterminate gender of some of these bodies and whatnot, or the confusion. Did the Egyptians have the same? They must have had very different ideas from the ideas that prevailed, let's say, in the last 2,000 years. So Nefertiti ruled as a male pharaoh. What's all that about?
Again, hard to be sure. and it's not absolutely definite. It's just that this seems to be the kind of the overwhelming weight of evidence. And there does seem to have been a fair degree of gender confusion at Amarna. So, you know, there are images of Akhenaten with Nefertiti where it's quite difficult to tell the two of them apart. They're both wearing pharaonic headdresses and both kind of have the contours of a female body. It's quite difficult. And the style of wig in this period is kind of Nubian style. And men and women, again, they're very similar. And so this is all part of the fun. adding to the complexity is you can't even be sure whether you're talking about men or women.
To add to your fun, I've basically got your dream question here from Mike Honcho. He says, Tom, he doesn't even bother addressing it to me. He just addressed it to you. Tom, do you subscribe to the idea that Akhenaten and Atenism was an important influence on the theology of Christianity? And he then says a second question, which I think is actually a very interesting question. Are there comparable examples you can think of in ancient history of a single individual, one individual who so completely transformed their culture? So let's do the first bit first, Christianity. Do you think it was an influence on Christianity?
No, I don't think so, because nobody knew about it. I mean, it is thought that Psalm 104 is and it contains within it an echo of
the hymn to the Artan.
Of the hymn to the Artan, yeah. And perhaps you could imagine that, I don't know, some Syrian subject of Pharaoh received it, and I mean, again, almost impossible to know. There is also the very enigmatic line in Acts of the Apostles, where it suddenly says, "And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians," which is kind of playing into the, you know, this idea that Moses was originally an Egyptian. But I don't think there's anything. I mean, I don't think Christians were aware of this at all. And are there other comparable examples you can think of in ancient history of a single individual that so completely, well, attempted to transform their own culture? In the long run, it didn't work. I can't think of anyone. And I think that's what makes it so interesting.
Yeah,
it's the unique fascination of this.
But that's what makes him seem so modern, isn't it? The new capital, the attempt to completely remake everything. I mean, that feels...
Yeah.
See, I can't think of that many examples of people doing that before the 20th century. That feels like something you do with 20th century technology and with a kind of 20th century utopianism. I mean, that's the weird thing, that there aren't people doing that in the 12th century or the 15th century. They're just continuing in the patterns of their predecessors. But Akhenaten is doing something unbelievably radical that we now associate with, you know, the Pol Pots and the Maos and the Stalins and so on.
Yeah, but to pick up on my Honcho's question, it is also quite kind of monotheistic in the sense of say, Christianity or I think particularly Islam. I think the kind of Islamic anxiety around images, the sense that gods that people have been worshipping are in fact idols and have to be overthrown. If there's a kind of a prefiguring of Christianity in the idea that Akhenaten is the son of the Artan, there is also a kind of definite, you know, a sense of Islam, the way in which Muhammad kind of, according to tradition, purges Mecca of idol worship. There is something there.
And also, I tell you what I also detect, Tom, there's a sort of, you know, they're both desert religions. There's an austerity to Atenism, if that's the right word.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
That it seems to share with Islam. There's a kind of simplicity in, I don't want to say, well, I mean, purity, maybe. There's a sort of a harsh simplicity to Atenism that you can see why it would intoxicate. It would frighten some and intoxicate others.
Yeah, and I think the harshness is the word. I mean, I think it left very little for people who weren't Pharaoh. And I think that was the problem.
Yeah. All right, we've just got time for a couple more questions. So lots of questions we had about Moses and monotheism, which we've kind of done. Tom Slist asks quite a different question. What do you think of Velikovsky's idea that Akhenaten was the inspiration for Oedipus?
Oh, good question. Are you au fait with Emmanuel Velikovsky?
I actually read him. He's bedside reading for me.
So Velikovsky was very controversial. I think he was an astronomer originally, who argued that Venus was in fact a chunk of Jupiter that in historical times had kind of migrated, and that this inspires all the kind of disaster apocalyptic myths that you get. And kind of as an extension of that, having, you know, radically rewritten astronomy, he then rewrites the entire history of the Near East as well, and argues that the conventional dating is completely wrong. So he said basically he kind of cuts out 1,000 years of history, so that Hatshepsut, the 18th dynasty queen, is associated with the Queen of Sheba, who, according to conventional dating, had lived centuries and centuries after Hatshepsut. So it's, let's say, it's not broadly accepted, although there are a couple of David Roll is the kind of example of historians who do make play with this idea that actually there are centuries that are kind of missing, and that if you get rid of them, then you can kind of map things up much more neatly. But Velikovsky's theory of Akhenaten, as Tom Sis says, is that he was the inspiration for Oedipus. And Velikovsky identifies Amenhotep III with Laius, who is Oedipus's father. And he identifies Amenhotep III's wife, Queen Tia, with Jocasta, who is the woman who Oedipus ends up marrying. And there are all kinds of play made with the fact that Oedipus lived in Thebes and Akhenaten lived in Thebes. And there are sphinxes in Egypt and there's a sphinx in the Oedipus story. And it's, you know,
it seems a bit desperate. Given
It's kind of fun, but it's nothing more than fun. So what do I think of it? It's a gameplay. It's all clearly right. Not true.
Well, my wife's just brought me a cup of tea, so that feels to me like, unless you really want to answer that question from Michael Ronson,
the beautiful lady has come.
Who made the big triangly things, Michael Ronson said. Aliens or not aliens, Tom?
I don't think aliens, no.
Oh, disappointing. Well, that's it for today. We've got Al Murray to come on Thursday, who's even more interesting than any of the pharaohs, or indeed Tom and me. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Tom. Bye for now.
Bye.